A very good morning to everyone. Our first case today is number 054322, Tricontinental Industries against Price Waterhouse. Mr. Truesdale.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mike Truesdale. I'm here on behalf of Tricontinental Industries and Tricontinental Distribution, plaintiffs below and appellants in this court. Your Honors, this is not a case brought by a speculative investor in the market who complains that an investment didn't turn out to be as lucrative as it was intended. Rather, this is a case where a publicly traded company relied upon arm's length negotiations in acquiring assets in exchange for its subsidiary. And this is not a case, Your Honors, where the underlying fraud is really subject to much dispute. The fraud has been alleged. The fraud has provided the basis for criminal investigations and for enforcement actions brought by the SEC. And because this is an appeal challenging a dismissal at the pleading stage, the big picture issue is whether the dismissal is appropriate. But applied, the question is whether it appears beyond a doubt there are no set of facts consistent with our allegations which we could show which would allow us to prevail.
And because the real trick here, of course, is that it's the accountants that you're suing, not the company that more directly was engaged in these fictitious transactions and manipulation of accounts receivable and so on and so forth. It's the accountant liability, and of course, under your federal theories, at least, the standard of pleading has become very strict.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. The point is, however, that the allegations that are contained in the complaint were sufficient to state a claim against the auditors.
But what's your loss causation theory for the federal claims? You seem to be arguing that loss causation is fairly obvious once you've shown transaction causation.
Your Honors, in this particular case, loss causation is established because the underlying fraud on which plaintiffs relied affected the financial statements and the audit of the financial statements in the year 1997. Subsequently, 22 months after the transaction, the company announced an investigation into accounting irregularities.
But does that go back forever? I mean, does every accountant that ever certified Anacom's books from the beginning of time forward liable on that theory as far as you're concerned?
Well, the question that you ask may be one that would be appropriate at a summary judgment stage or at some stage down the road.
Why is that so? I mean, I don't understand that, because it seems to me your theory is that you didn't need to focus in particular on the 1997 statements because they carry forward, they affect 98, 99, eventually in 2000, all of this starts coming out. But I am not sure why you don't need to focus with some particularity on the given years that you say were misrepresented.
Well, Your Honor, a corporate fraud may take place by way of numerous transactions occurring over numerous periods of time.
Okay. And if that's the case, as you understand the pleading rules now, don't you need to specify what those numerous transactions were, even if it's a fairly long period of time?
Your Honor, I believe that we specify the transactions. The question, however, for loss causation is whether the misrepresentation on which we relied is tied to a subsequent disclosure. And not necessarily, Dura does not require that the particular transaction be disclosed. What Dura requires is that an event occurs by which the truth about the underlying transaction begins to leak out, begins to become known. And that makes sense, Your Honor, because it very well may be that a partial disclosure could cause catastrophic consequences, and it's just by accident rather than by necessity that only one component of the fraud is revealed.
I understand that, but I guess I still am concerned with going back to the 1997 fraud, which is the one that would have affected the purchase of the stock, right? I mean, later on, the stock was already purchased, so it didn't trigger the purchase. and sort of this ledger domain that's causing you to reach back to the 97 fraud because it later gets reflected in the 98 and 99 statements.
Well, I think that demonstrates the point that I'm trying to make, is that the component of the underlying fraud carries forward, and not only carries forward...
But why not 1996 then, or 1995? I mean, how far back does this theory go? I mean, if this company was managing itself in a dishonest way, then how far back does it go?
Well, from a pleading standpoint, to satisfy Dura, and recall, this, Your Honor, you requested at the outset about the pleading standard for the federal claims, and it is clear from Dura that the loss causation element does not require heightened pleading. It requires a short and plain statement of the relationship between the misrepresentation alleged and the injury suffered. And if a misrepresentation, you know, obviously the farther you go back, the more difficult it could be. But the point is that the difficulty will arise at the proof stage. The difficulty will arise at summary judgment or at other stages. But for the purposes of satisfying the pleading requirement, all that is required is a short and plain statement of the misrepresentation and a causal nexus between a later event by which the truth about that misrepresentation began to leak out. Certainly, if the truth had been known in 1997, you know, from the transaction standpoint, transaction causation side, you know, we certainly wouldn't have entered the transaction. But the point is that going forward, the fraud that occurred in 1997, you know, and the allegations throughout the complaint are replete with references to the fact that, you know, what happened in 98 was a direct response to what happened in 97. It was needed to roll over, to continue. The fraud in 97 was entrenched by the time that 98 arrived, and everything that happened in 98 was part and parcel of a continuing fraud by the same individuals and the same auditor. And so it's not that attenuated to say that what happened in 97 satisfies the pleading requirement to allege a relationship between that loss and a subsequent disclosure. And that subsequent disclosure by which the truth about 97 subsequently began to leak out.
Yeah, which isn't until 2000, right? And I take it your position with respect to the state negligent misrepresentation claims is that you're not under any heightened pleading requirement at all for that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because on that as well, I have some concerns about loss causation, frankly, you know, about showing how these representations, how the 1997 audit opinion caused your clients, and I guess your opponents have also made a big point about who your clients actually are, you know, which company got the stock, which company wound up holding it at the time of the loss. You might want to say a word about that, but there's the same causation issue, I think, in the negligent representation claim.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the negligent misrepresentation claim, you know, the common law claim requires, and we can talk about the specifics of the allegations that were alleged below and the basis for the ruling on the negligent misrepresentation claim momentarily, but with respect to the causation, the loss causation component, we relied upon misrepresentations about the state of the financial affairs at Anacom. In 2000, the state of the financial affairs at Anacom were called into question, and the consequence of that event was that it injured us. And I think that is all that is required to satisfy loss causation. This isn't like Dura, where we can just speculate that we bought at an inflated price, and we allege nothing more. We allege a direct correlation between the accounting irregularities that occurred in 97 and the disclosure of accounting irregularities. And recall, Dura does not require a specific allegation of doesn't require a specific allegation of a particular event. It requires an event by which the truth begins to leak out. And it's our contention that the truth about everything began to leak out when Anacom made its disclosure.
Mm-hmm. So what is your theory for the reason why we should disregard the separate corporate identity of the two companies involved at your end?
Your Honor, I'll be happy to address that. The complaint alleges that Tricontinental Industries was the direct or indirect owner of all of the various Texcan entities. And you know, the names have changed, but you can refer to them as the Texcan Canada and Texcan Domestic entities.
Right, but did the parent sell the assets of the subsidiary, though?
The parent was...
I thought this was an asset sale. Maybe that's wrong.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, but the parent was the 100% shareholder. The parent was the one who was at the negotiating table. The parent was the one who the representations were made to. And the parent was the one who subsequently received the shares. The parent was the one who was injured, ultimately injured by the transaction. And it's important that no allegations regarding the relationship between the parties was made below. And if there were questions about that, certainly those are issues that we could address either by responsive briefing in the trial court or by way of an amendment that would clarify any concerns that were raised. But I certainly don't think that raises any points that should give this court cause for concern, because the allegations contained within the complaint are that the Tricontinental Industries or that the plaintiffs were injured by the representations. So...
Right. I mean, it's usually the case, though, if it's a parent-subsidiary relationship, that if the parent is going to be injured by something that happened to the subsidiary, it's functionally through, you know, dividend. It's through some form of financial flow that goes from a subsidiary company to a parent, because we don't normally disregard corporate formalities unless there's some reason given to us to do so.
Well, and Your Honor, the point I guess I'm making is that... If there were a complaint about the adequacy of how we alleged the corporate structure, you know, I'm kind of confined by the record that we have us, which is paragraph 5 of the complaint and the relationship between the entities at that point. That is certainly something that I could have addressed with precision and with more clarity had the opportunity arisen. And I'll be happy to address it in more detail outside the record, but the point that I'm making is that from a pleading standpoint, the adequacy of our pleading of that relationship was not challenged below.
Okay.
So. Your Honors, I see that I'm at the conclusion of my time. If there are any other questions, other than that, we respect the request that this court reverse the judgments below and remand this court case to the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Truesdale. We'll hear now from Mr. Boland.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jim Boland on behalf of PricewaterhouseCoopers. Much of what I think is at issue in the case has been set forth in the parties' briefs, and there are a lot of different points and arguments that were made, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have about those. But I wanted to focus on two elements about these claims that I think pick up on what Judge Wood was saying just a few minutes ago, and that is that we have two different plaintiffs suing us here. We've got Tricontinental Distribution Limited, and we've got Tricontinental Industries. And I want to separate those claims out, and I want to explain why we think that they fail. And I think that Tricontinental Distribution Limited's claims fail outright because of loss causation. I mean, all of the claims that are asserted in this case, securities fraud, common law fraudulent inducement, common law fraudulent concealment, and negligent misrepresentation, require a loss proximately caused by the conduct. Here, we don't have a single allegation in the complaint that demonstrates that Tricontinental Distribution, which received its stock from Anacom and then turned it over to its parent, wasn't fully compensated in whatever format that those parties deemed appropriate in that second transaction. And we've got evidence of that. The other corporate subsidiary to this transaction isn't here. They didn't sue. They turned their stock over to their parent the same way. There is no allegation that in that second transaction there was not adequate consideration given and received. And I think that the court is right that there is no reason to disregard the corporate relationships here. And for that reason, we think that all of Tricontinental Distribution's claims fail.
But why, looking at the parent corporation, isn't it the case that they were ultimately damaged by this? They get stock, true, from their subsidiary, from one of the things that they own, and then that turns out to be so much paper, actually, by the time Anacom files for bankruptcy.
Well, and the parent is a party here.
Right.
And the parent is asserting claims. I guess the question is, what damages are they claiming based on what transactions and under what legal theories?
And why can't they trace back, though, to the original transfer of Anacom shares to the sub, to Tricon Distribution?
Well, what I would say, Judge, is that I believe that is really disregarding the corporate realities of this transaction. This transaction was in a public document filed with the SEC by Anacom. The parties to this transaction were Anacom, Inc., Anacom Multimedia Wiring Systems, Inc., and the three Texcan subsidiaries. Tricontinental Industries was not a party to that transaction. Now, if Tricontinental Industries claims that it was damaged in some fashion, then it can figure out how it was damaged, and then it can determine whether it's got a proper cause of action on a proper theory. And we've got four theories that that company is asserting here. They're asserting the same four theories, basically: negligent misrepresentation, fraudulent inducement, fraudulent concealment, and then securities fraud. And I would say that with respect to the three common law theories, they're simply out, because the common law theories in these complaints, both of the complaints, are based on the underlying transaction between Anacom and the affiliates. I don't believe that they should be allowed to come back and sue for that conduct when that is they are not the parties that were the parties to that agreement. The contract here speaks for itself.
But I wanted to ask you, though, about the negligent misrepresentation point, because it seems to me that the district court may have erred in looking at the elements of that, in that, as I read the district court's opinion, it seems to call for the auditor to make a contemporaneous verification of an audit to the third party who's relying on it. And I don't find that anywhere in the Illinois law that addresses accountant liability to third parties.
Well, number one, I would agree that Illinois law does not have a per se independent verification requirement.
That's, and so to the extent the district court thought there was, that at least is a mistake.
Well, I don't believe that the district court necessarily dismissed the claim based on independent verification. That was one. What the district court did, both in its opinion dismissing the claim and also on reconsideration, is look at the allegations of the complaint when measured against the guidance from Illinois appellate courts about what it is that a non-party in Illinois must allege in terms of conduct to demonstrate not only that an auditor such as PwC was aware that its client's primary intent, and primary is the key word there, primary intent was for the audit work to benefit a third party, but also, in the first instance, that the client's primary intent was for that audit work. And if we look at the allegations of the complaint, all you really have in terms of Anacom's conduct here is the allegation that they provided their audited financial statements to a potential counterparty in a transaction.
Well, but there is no special 9B type or PLSRA type pleading requirement for this common law claim. And one place I'm looking for it where you're citing it, it has to be a primary intent. It doesn't have to be the primary intent. And the allegations here, anyway, are that that a primary intent was to further this acquisition strategy, and that PricewaterhouseCoopers was well aware of that.
Well, I would submit that the allegations of the complaint have to also be, the actual factual allegations ought to be considered in context with the conclusion that it was Anacom's primary intent and Pricewaterhouse knew about that. The factual allegations simply don't support that conclusion. All they really say about Anacom's conduct in terms of primary intent is that they gave audited financial statements to a counterparty. But even putting that aside, where that comes out, I believe, Your Honor, is with respect to Tricontinental Distribution's claims in terms of this growth by acquisition strategy, in terms of selling its acquiring businesses from counterparties. That transaction was not with Tricontinental Industries. And so the Tricontinental Distribution doesn't have a claim because it has no damages. So if we look at Tricontinental...
Well, that gets you back to your corporate entity point. But if we were to disagree with that and see this as somehow a more unified set of transactions... That's where I'm trying to focus on the elements of this negligent misrepresentation claim, because it seems to me that the complaint does allege both the primary intent element and the knowledge element, which is what the Illinois statute looks for.
I don't believe that the complaint's allegations can fairly be read to establish both of those elements of the cause of action.
Well, to establish, but if there's no special pleading requirement, then you're making a summary judgment argument here.
Well, I think that the allegations of the complaint can't be considered in isolation. There is a conclusion pled of Anacom's primary intent and PwC's knowledge, but if you consider that against the factual allegations, I don't think they ought to be disregarded in terms of determining whether or not that conclusion that's pled is supported. The factual allegations really are that Anacom provided its audited financial statements to a counterparty in a transaction, and that PwC apparently knew about that. Well, if that were the test, then you could state a claim against any counterparty to a transaction can probably state a claim against a public company's outside independent auditor in federal court. And I don't believe that that's what the Illinois courts are telling us are the, it should be the requirements for pleading such a claim under Illinois law. And I recognize that there's a bit of a conflict here between what Illinois courts have required and what the federal courts would require. But it ought not to be the case that at least the minimum factual allegations that are required by state court in this regard should also be required or at least considered in a complaint pleading the claim in federal court. Because if the claim wouldn't survive in state court, it ought not to survive in federal court.
But that's plainly wrong. I mean, because we all the time say that claims that would not survive in state court, because Illinois happens to be a fact-pleading, code-pleading state, do survive in federal court, because there's notice pleading in the federal courts, and if there's any set of facts consistent with the allegations of the complaint, I mean, I'm sure we can all recite this in our sleep, then you can go forward to the next step in federal court. So it actually is routine that something that would be dismissed in state court will survive.
And again, all I would point back to is what this complaint tries. I mean, the complaints are the amended complaint, 69 pages, 180 paragraphs, second amended, 85 pages, 229. They go to great lengths to set up all of the facts that they claim support these allegations. And it's our view that when you apply those against Illinois appellate court guidance in terms of what it is that shows that A, client's primary intent was for the audit work to benefit a third party, and then B, that the auditor knew that.
But you can't argue that you have no notice from this complaint that they are trying to make a third-party accountant liability claim against you and that they have pleaded the primary intent and knowledge elements that the Illinois courts have imposed.
I think, Your Honor,
it sounds to me like you're almost trying to make a claim of pleading yourself out of court by putting so many facts in that you can't possibly prevail. But that's rarely something that works unless, you know, there's a 2-year statute of limitations and you say it happened 10 years ago or something like that that appears in the face of the complaint to be fatal to your ability to go forward.
Well, accepting that, I think that still only relates to the parties to the transaction, because the limited issue here is Anacom's growth by acquisition strategy, the desire that sellers of businesses rely on the representations. I don't believe that it's fair from this complaint to say that this pleads that Anacom's primary intent was for a corporate parent in later intra-corporate transactions to rely not simply on the financial statements that Anacom provided, but also on the audit work that the accountants did on that several months earlier, and further a stretch to say that PwC knew of that, it was aware of that primary intent. And that's where we get to the Illinois case law and what Illinois cases have looked to determine whether those elements are satisfied, and that's what I believe a fair reading is of what the district court did.
Is it your position that PwC, in some sense, shouldn't be held to have known those things that this unsavory, the primary accountant on the account knew?
No, Your Honor. I mean,
you agree that PwC knew what he knew.
Absolutely. We don't dispute that PwC knew what Mr. Seidelman knew, but all that the complaint has ever been able to say about Mr. Seidelman personally is that the SEC took issue with our auditing of 3 or 4 discrete issues in the 1999 annual audit and the first quarter of 2000 interim review. That's a disagreement over whether we followed proper procedures in those later time periods. They don't have anything to do with the time period preceding the transaction with the Texcans entities. But we don't disagree that we would know what Mr. Seidelman knew, but it certainly doesn't suggest that Mr. Seidelman knew, for example, with Tricontinental Industries, that Tricontinental Industries was going to be relying on PwC's audit opinion in later intracorporate transactions with its subsidiaries.
It does seem a little fanciful. I mean, it seems the other thing that you're saying really is more of a public policy argument. Surely people do rely and are intended to rely on audit opinions from reputable accounting firms that say we've examined the books and we've applied generally accepted accounting principles and the like, and this fairly states the company's financial position. I mean, people, that's why you get them. That's why you have these companies. And so to say that nobody relies on them is a little otherworldly, isn't it?
Well, I think that's the purpose of the Illinois Public Accounting Act. The purpose of the Illinois Public Accounting Act is to set some principal limits on the scope of liability of accounting companies such as my client to the mass of parties in the world who we understand will see SEC filings. We understand we'll see Form 10-Ks. We understand we'll see audit opinions.
And we'll rely to an important degree on the fact that somebody, hopefully a reputable firm, has said this is good.
And that's why I believe the Illinois Public Accounting Act contains the provisions about the primary intent directed at a particular third party, and then
it doesn't say a particular third party
to the third party bringing the suit, I believe.
But there's Illinois case law to suggest that you could be in the class of people that the accounting firm anticipated.
I understand that there's case law to suggest that you could be in the class of people that could be anticipated to rely on that. I think that's in the context of the fraudulent inducement claim that's cited, but I do agree with that. And again, if we look at Tricontinental Industries, the company that held the stock that claims damages, they're simply not within that class. They didn't sell their assets to Anacom. The subsidiary sold the assets to Anacom. Finally, with respect to Tricontinental Industries, I think that really the only claim that they have a basis to attempt to assert a securities fraud, and we believe that claim is barred by loss causation. And there were two announcements in this case, both of which related to 1998 and 1999 in the first quarter of 2000 only, both of which, including the last one, neither of which mentioned 1997. And in fact, there was never a statement that 1997 was correct or incorrect or in any way. One thing I would mention about the flow over and the partial disclosure of the fraud, that's really not supported by the allegations of the complaint, other than the conclusory ones. What you have is them alleging that there are certain transactions that caused 1997 to be misstated. We disagree with their characterizations of that, but that's what they allege. But then what we have is a whole series of transactions alleged in quite in detail in the complaint. Again, we disagree that we have any liability for them, but they caused 1998's results to be wrong, 1999 and 2000. There is no allegation, and I know of no basis for one, that this company would not have been doing the exact same things it was doing in 1998, 1999, and 2000, whether the 1997 results were misstated or not. In fact, the complaint allegation says that beginning in the first quarter of 1998, the company realized it was in big financial difficulty. The issue here is, but for the misrepresentation alleged, i.e., in this case, that the 1997 financial statements were fair, they wouldn't have suffered the loss. 1998 and 1999 caused them to suffer the loss. We believe the district court's decision should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Boland. How much time does Mr. Truesdale have? Thank you. 3.5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honors, this is not a case that should be dismissed on the pleadings, and nothing that we just heard justifies the dismissal of the pleadings, particularly in light of the references to the entities, the particular entities. And there's nothing in the record, and there's nothing in the pleadings, which indicates that there's an issue with respect to the corporate form, et cetera, that couldn't be remedied by the pleading, or couldn't be shown by the pleading, or couldn't be shown by the evidence. This is simply not a pleading issue at this stage, particularly at the appellate stage, when issues about the adequacy and the relationship of the parties was never raised as a ground for dismissal below. Certainly, we could have been more than happy to clarify any issues that they had we been given the opportunity. But it does not show any per se reason why we cannot prevail on a claim at the pleading stage, and therefore...
So knowing now what you know about their argument about corporate entity, what would you add to your pleadings?
Well, I would address any particular response they had.
They've pretty much laid it out, right?
I don't think that there's any defect in the pleading the way it's alleged. Okay, I could add factual allegations showing the relationship and how Tricontinental, the parent, actually relied. And this is a very important point, and I think that it gets missed. PwC suggests that because Tricontinental Industries wasn't the company whose assets were sold, they couldn't rely or they couldn't be injured, and that's just not the case. Certainly they did rely on everything that happened, and it was their reliance that allowed the transactions to go forward, or it is their reliance. I mean, they were relying lockstep. They were the ones who were at the table. They were the ones who ultimately benefited.
Suppose the subs had kept those shares of stock. Would you be here saying that the parent was injured from the fraud? Now the subs are holding a bunch of worthless stock from Anacom instead of the parent.
Your Honor, I would have to think on how I would caption that phrase. Off the top of my head, I don't know how that would change my situation. But the point is that this was a transaction where that, you know, basically the stock was conveyed almost contemporaneously with the transaction. So mm-hmm. And everybody knew that. And it's important also to note that PwC not only knew that, they were recipients of the asset purchase agreement drafts, which clarified and spelled all this out. This is not a surprise, and this is not anything new. Mm-hmm. And the other point I wanted to raise with respect to the negligent misrepresentation claim, because I think this court is precisely correct. The claims, the allegations required under the IPAA were satisfied by the complaints. And not only were they expressly satisfied by express allegations, but they were buttressed by specific allegations that added to that. For example, the fact that PwC was a part of the negotiations team. They were the ones conducting due diligence. They were the ones receiving drafts of the APA. The allegation that they knew that Anacom intended PwC or Tricontinental to rely on the documents, it's not a naked allegation in any event. And in any event, the allegation is sufficient. And certainly this court is correct that there is no requirement under law that there be an independent verification. For these reasons, we respectfully request that this court reverse the judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Truesdale.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement.